Welcome to episode one of Not a Number. I'm Carl. Today I've got Chris with me, Chris Stone Street.
Hi, everybody.
So, to start with, I'm Carl Bowden. I work at Mezzanine in Newcastle, and I am a full stack developer. Yeah, so front end, back end, mobile dev. And you?
Yeah, so my title at the moment is a senior UX designer at NIB Health Funds. And I've been doing that to date for about 6 to 7 weeks in that role in a corporate environment.
And I've also known Chris for a while as well. And I know that this is a fairly big change for him. I moved into agency work about a year ago out of freelance. And I'd worked with Chris and alongside Chris doing freelance work as well. What's been... the biggest change you've noticed going into corporate environments?
Yeah. So before I went into corporate, I thought the biggest change for me would be adapting to full-time employment again. Even though with a freelance lifestyle, there's that notion that, yes, you can pick and choose your hours. The reality of it is, okay, you can start at 10 o'clock, but you're probably going to be finishing up at about 1 a.m. in the morning. And that's not a typical working day. So I thought that for me, the biggest adjustment would be going back, working for the man, and having to start at 8:30 or 9 o'clock, working all the way through till 5:30, 6 o'clock, whatever it may be, with someone, with the assumption that someone would be looking over your shoulder. And I think that's was set in my mind from just previous experience of certain agencies that I worked in where, yes, you were under the pump. And there was a lot of pressure. And I thought that's, for me, would be a hard adjustment going back into full-time employment. But it wasn't the case when I actually took that deep dive into that position. It didn't play out like that. So I think that what was appealing with NIB is there's a whole range of or spectrum of things that they do that were appealing, but there is no reporting to an art director. There is no reporting to a creative director. A lot of the design is on your shoulders. A lot of the decisions that you make as a designer are on your shoulders. And you do work with a really good team, but at the end of the day, you're there to sail your ship. And there's people around you to support you with your arguments and decisions that you make, but at the end of the day, it's you leading the charge. And I think that was interesting because when I was thinking of going back into full-time employment, I was scared about or hesitant about the hours and the structure. But it turns out it's working out for the best. It's not what I thought it would be.
Yeah. Like when I started, there was always that, from past experience, from other places I've worked, there's always that fear that you're just going to be used and abused, that you were just going to be worked into the ground. When, in actual fact, when now that I have somebody looking over me, there's less chance that I work myself into the ground. It turns out that was much more of a risk when I was freelancing, that because there was nobody to stop me from working, I'd just keep working until I couldn't stay awake anymore, go to sleep, get up the next day, start again. And not only that, but it's also been freeing in not having to worry about looking for work and where the next paycheck's coming from. Not that the, even if it's not financially different at all, it's a lot more freeing in that I can go to work and I know that I can focus on the development side, learning what I need to. And not having to worry where the next job is coming in from after I finish this one.
That's a really good point because people, if they've never done freelance before, they assume that the work would just come to them. And to make that a reality, it takes a lot of time. But to get there, you have a lot of work. So the problem I found is you have to do all the work. It's not, the reality of it is you're probably sitting down at the computer designing 20% of the time. There's a lot of the legwork that's happening under the surface. It's that annotation of the duck swimming on the water. The legs are going crazy underneath, but it's smooth sailing across the top. And only people see that stuff that's happening on the top from an outside perspective. And the issue I found for myself was, so when I was working in agencies, I was doing the design, I was client liaising, I was liaising with any feds offshore and in local as well.
By feds, he means front-end developers?
Front-end developers, sorry. Cool. Yep. So I was liaising with those myself, and it came to a point where I thought, you know, I could do this on my own. And for the birth of my first child, I thought, this is probably the best time to do it and not to be afraid to fail and have a go at it. The problem I found over the... So I freelanced for about 2.5 years, and in that time, how do you measure success? That's probably another topic, but I did pretty well in terms of, I never really had a website. It was always under construction. I think I did one run of business cards and I still have half a pack, and that was only a run of like 100 nice bespoke cards. So we did pretty well in terms of just word of mouth. And that's another conversation that we could go into as well, that, you know, work can come to you if you do good work, people will acknowledge that. The problem is that to maintain that, it's a lot of work. And as I went forward in the 2.5 years of my freelance career, I actually found that I was moving from design, which is what I was passionate about. So that's UX, UI, interactive, whatever title you want to put on it. I called myself a digital designer, but I actually started finding myself moving more towards project management, taking up a lot of time, and starting to have to move into an area for front-end development, which isn't my strong point. HTML, CSS, yeah, you know, I can feel through the dark on that one. But when it became to anything like jQuery, any behavioral stuff, yes, that's when I would sort of draw the line in sand and hit the panic button and say, I can't do that. So with freelance, I had to rely a lot on other people to help produce the work. And it became very draining. It was quite tricky to keep connections and to keep things going. Everybody has things going on in their lives that are different, which can pull them or bring them into a project. And when I actually sat back and looked at, you know, what I studied for, what I was passionate about, I was actually not doing anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And when I first went into freelance, the idea was to do more of this. But it just didn't happen. The reality is it just didn't happen. And that's when I needed to work out, you know, are you happy, Chris? Are you happy continue doing this and trying to fix it but never knowing if it'll work perfectly? Or is it best to cut your losses and go and work full-time somewhere else? In that whole two-year period, I did contract work for corporate organizations, and I found that it was an area where I thought I would never get back into a corporate world. And I sort of said to myself, yeah, if I was to go back into full-time, it would have to be in an agency, but an agency with an attitude that they could change the behavior of somebody or change the world, let's say. So I was very selective if I was going to go back into full-time employment about who I was going to join. And I think when NIB came about, we had a first round of interviews. So the time it took me from my very first interview to where I am now, or when I started, we're probably talking about 4 months of that process. But the first time I went for an actual interview and we started that process of coming on board, I did pull the chain. I said, no, I think at this time, for many different reasons of salaries, projects that were happening, you know, it's probably not the right time. But then... So I was giving a speech to the Department of Trade and Industry, and it was a talk about understanding your customers, but also collaborating with your customers. And it wasn't until I walked out of that presentation that I thought to myself, I'm not doing this. I'm not doing this anymore. I'm not practicing what I'm preaching. I was lucky enough to have a bit of an insight into this corporate organization that is evoking change in the health industry. Maybe it's time to pivot, change course and join them and focus my energies on that. So it wasn't a black and white answer. There was a lot of and I'm a list person, there's a lot of pros and cons.
Mm.
But after a while, the pros started outweighing the cons. So that was my decision.
And it's good to see you with some colour in your face again too.
Yes.
Rather than the nails all turning white, so you try to claw your way back up.
Yeah. I think if we were to talk about freelance a bit more, it's an isolating world. It really is isolating. Even though you join up with a co-working space like Carl and myself did, and that's how we kind of met paths. It's great for building.
Which was one of the best things I ever did.
Yeah, twofold.
Just meeting other people that are freelancers, maybe not even in the same industry, but other people that are going through the same struggles at that time as well, learning how they deal with customers, clients, people not paying bills, contracts.
Yeah.
Just knowing that there are other people going through those same things at the same time as well is so helpful.
And a lot of that stuff you only learn on the ground that you can't really get from a blog or reading a book. You need to submerge yourself around people that are experiencing the same pain points and heartache and seeing how they deal with that and how you can bring that into your own environment.
Yeah, and you're not going to understand it until you're in that situation as well.
Yeah. So I think when I joined a co-working space, it helped on a lot of factors. It helps obviously bring out your confidence in what you do and helps validate what you do because you're seeing other people doing the same thing. It helps you build up a network to bounce ideas across with other people. It helps you build up a network of resources and suppliers. So to me, Carl would be a supplier as a developer. That's great. But over time, you need to start to be mindful that everybody's working on their own projects. And there comes a point where you think, okay, I'm stuck on on my own project or a client project. This person, for example, say Carl, who's not actually money invested in on this project, so he's not being paid for it. Where do you draw the line in terms of asking for favors for help? And it's quite a difficult thing that you need to sort of build up a relationship. It's kind of like when you first go to school and you're new to this school. A, you need to work out how everybody works at that school. Kids, who do you make friends with? You need to work out how certain teachers work. You need to work out certain areas of the playground that you can go to. So you've really got to feel the waters before you do anything.
That sounds very different to my experience at school.
Right. Well, there you go. Everyone has
the
a different
only thing
path.
I needed to know is where to hide so I don't get beaten up.
Same. And who to avoid, what's their regular path when they get to school, how to avoid them. But I think it's reminiscent of a co-working space of you're there to try and do the best you can do, either if that's starting a business or perfecting your craft, but not being afraid to rely on the people as a resource in that space, but being very mindful of people in that space that they're all doing their own work. And that's very draining. That's very...
And they've all got different personalities and styles that you need to learn to be able to interact with and how different people react to you coming to work and taking your socks off and hanging them on the monitor to dry out. I mean, you still need to worry about the same things when you're at work as well, but in a co-working space, it gets a lot more clicky because everybody's there fighting for their own wins. It feels a lot more competitive at times than being in a workspace, working for a company.
Mm.
And it's very easy. I agree with the balance of how you treat people. It's very easy to go from treating somebody as a supplier to treating them as a tool.
Yep.
It's something that you use to whack a nail to get a job done. And it's very easy for that to then move to destroying relationships and friendships.
Yep.
As soon as you're delivering something to a client and that client is unhappy with it and that's something that somebody else in your team has done, it's very hard to fight against the resentment feeling against that person that's done that work when they're making you look bad, when in fact the responsibility still lies with you because you're the one delivering it. And it's just a natural inclination that we have.
Yeah, yeah.
So one of the other interesting plays inside the workplace is between the designers and developers. Chris and I have been talking about this in previous occasions. And there seems to be a lot of, you see a lot of designers moving towards using Sketch as opposed to Illustrator or Photoshop, which I think is a wonderful thing. The designs that I'm given in Sketch, I find a lot easier to interact with to find the information that I need out of them, to be able to turn that into a design that is closer to what that designer had in mind. But there's always that disconnect between what a designer has in their head and put on paper versus what you can build and how do you get something that is what that designer wants without 100 rounds of revisions and changes and so many missed meanings in the design. If they draw a navigation heading on a page, is the content meant to flow under it? Does it stay fixed? Does it shrink when the page scrolls up? Those sort of things are just so hard to convey in a flat design. And sometimes you just want to give them the browser and tell them to go do it themselves.
Yeah, it's true. I think where, so let's backpedal a little bit. When we think about the tools that we use, so when web design started to come about, it was, so I was lucky enough to be studying back in 2000, sort of when the boom of the web was happening. And Photoshop was the tool to go to at the time because buttons were images. Basically, everything was images. Everything was sliced. Everything was then built into tables. But at that time, as we go forward, we need to remember that Photoshop was primarily built for photographers. There was no such thing as Lightroom or anything, I don't think, at the time. So other designers then would say, well, I'm more comfortable with vectors, so I'll use Illustrator. Now I'm learning a bit of web, I'll stick with Illustrator. We always had to sort of use tools that weren't for us, but to make them work for us to be able to achieve that outcome of a digital product or a web design. It's very similar to the Quark versus InDesign sort of story, and you can read more up on that online. But then I think Sketch came out and said, well, Adobe, you've had a pretty good stronghold on the market. We're kind of now combining this sort of digital or web platform to use this tool. We can now quickly export what we need to, even though a lot of the components are built now using CSS3. There was sort of a tool that allowed us, or was a voice for us, to do what we wanted to do. But the problem is time, over time, change takes time. And a lot of designers in any industry, they still prefer to use a certain tool because it's that argument of how much time do I invest in learning a new tool to the time it would actually take me to achieve the same outcome using a tool that I already use. But I think the challenge is when you're working in a collaborative environment, whether that's freelance or internal at an agency or internal at a corporate organization, it's sort of stepping up to the plate saying, how do I change my procedures, the tools that I use, to make that other person's life a bit easier when I have to hand this off?
Yeah.
And now we're looking at these sort of online tools that we were talking about previously, Reflow, which has been cancelled now, or not being built upon by Adobe, Macor, Webflow, all these sort of in-browser building tools. Do they actually make a developer's life easier or a designer's life easier? A designer has to learn.
Or neither.
Yeah. Where do you sort of stick with what you know, stick with what you're good at, and then hope that that other person that you're handing it off to or working in collaboration with, such as a developer, that they'll be able to understand your, or empathize with you, but you also need to empathize with the developer as well.
So I wonder if there's any other analogies that we could use. What other design and art forms, backgrounds have you been involved in? I know that you've done a bit of print design. Any paint, like wet work?
Nothing.
I'd liken it to a painter who sketches out on a piece of paper a wireframe, scribbles an outline of a face that they then want to then go and paint onto a canvas.
Okay.
And it gives them an idea of a reference that they can refer to. But at the same time, they're not going to use the pencil to do all of the painting with. They're not going to do all of the painting on a piece of paper. and then try and blow it up and transfer it onto a canvas.
Yeah, okay.
And sometimes wonder whether we should just be teaching all designers to use HTML and CSS. And then I realize how long it's taken me to learn all of the quirks.
Exactly. So when I think back to my experiences of working for myself, and so the normal waterfall process, I would say, for anybody that's working for themselves, and a lot of listeners probably feel the same, is that you start with a brief, you liaise with a client, you know, you work out the problems from the business objective side. If you're fortunate enough, you can start to think about user experience and how a user would use this online tool or product. And then, yes, you would move into, you'd sketch something out. You would, if you're lucky enough, you would sort of wireframe it and have the client involved in that process. Then you'd move into something a bit more high fidelity. And then a freelancer might talk to another freelancer developer and help get that build out and then implement that into a CMS. And then you do the content rollout and then you're live. And then there's a whole other bunch of issues with browser testing and client wanting to do changes now that they've actually seen it in the browser. So I'm sure a lot of listeners probably had that same problem. But then when you're doing it for yourself and you're running your own little business, you sort of think, okay, how do I increase my profit and limit and lessen the amount of work, physical labor work that I need to do to still meet the same outcome and objectives in terms of quality of work, what the client wants, what the users want. And I think that's where you need to start to work out. Yes, you'll need to always sketch out an idea. Like Carl said, a painter would sketch, you know, they would sketch their character or they'd sketch the landscape quickly to see if the composition's right, scale is correct. But then it's, what do I do next? Do I just jump straight into watercolor and start filling this thing in? Do I do a couple of tests on some scrap paper and get color palettes ready? So there's areas of, you know, yeah, can you just quickly do a style tile? Get the client to sign off on a style tile, educate them about a style tile. And then just do a couple of key pages as a mock-up, get them built, and then build the rest of the pages out based upon the content.
Style tiles have been one of the best things I've seen come into practice lately. The more I see people using style tiles, the more it helps them, the client, understand that what they've been presented isn't actually the final design. And there used to be a lot of tendency for clients to see a design, approve it, and expect what's then produced afterwards to be exactly the same.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas using something like a style tile, you're not presenting them what the final, not something that can be interpreted as the final product. You're presenting them a feel for what the final product will be like.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, part of it's the client expectation that they expect you to be able to read their mind and for everything to come out right the first time. And part of it's also the process of finding enough time to be able to produce something in a cost-effective way. And I've seen a lot of freelancers try and tackle that by using offshore developers and workers, putting things through Elance to try and increase their productivity. And it might decrease the costs for the person doing the work, but every time I've seen it happen, it hasn't been to the positive outcome of the project.
Mm-hmm.
Introduced delays and more rounds of revision, more corrections, and things that are further and further away from what the client actually had in their head, because it's just so hard to convey that to somebody who's so far away, who you've never met.
Mm-hmm. And I'm guilty as charged. If
Ditto.
Yeah, where I think because it's that thing of we're all trying to work smarter, not harder. And cost is a big part of that. And timelines are a big part of that. And if you're working for yourself, there's only so much you can do in a day before you burn yourself out. And yeah, if you're throwing it offshore, and offshoring's not a bad or a dirty word. We need to be mindful of that. Offshoring is finding somebody to help either do some of the workload or to do something that a specific task that you're not comfortable doing. It's not saying I'm charging the world for this product, but I'm actually paying somebody overseas a really reduced price to make the same thing. So we need to be clear about how offshoring actually should be perceived. But in the real world, people still do that. They still try to, you know, increase their margins and get somebody else to do the work cheaper. And I think that's an area of digital design that's always under pressure that everybody has now Photoshop. Everybody can now quickly learn a tutorial online to build something, and they can do it at half the price. It's always a battle with clients actually seeing value in what this person can give back.
Yeah.
I think, though, as a freelancer in that environment, when you're doing it for yourself, and if, say, for example, you're not outsourcing or you're just working with a developer locally, it's how do I or how do you streamline your processes? Maybe it is, okay, here's the brief. Here's a couple of wireframes of a structure, supporting with a style tile, educating the client on what those two things are, and then moving straight into designing in the browser. For a couple of reasons, I think it's more of being able to show a client, okay, this is how a responsive website looks. Yes, it's not 100% perfect. You might even just be using a responsive wireframe, but then they can start to understand behavioral components of how this is going to play out on a mobile device, how it's going to display on a big screen TV. And from there, as a designer, you're kind of now saying, well, I'm doing a bit of front-end development. I might not be doing the behavioral stuff with jQuery, but I'm doing HTML and CSS. And whether that's straight into Sublime Text or using Dreamweaver or whatever tool you choose to use to get that done, or an online tool such as Macor or Webflow, it's about streamlining your processes, but you're learning something as you go. You're learning as a designer, I get how columns work. I get now how media queries work. I get how sizes render online. I get that I shouldn't always be using pixels. Maybe rems and EMs are the best way to go. I'm learning as I go. Plus, I'm also teaching a client as well. Then when it gets to the point that the client's happy with what you've produced in terms of a stage or a concept, when you actually need to then hand it off, whether that's offshoring or work with a developer locally, you should have, I'm going to just spitball a percentage here, you should have at least have about 80 or 90% of the questions or issues worked out, because you don't always get the answer with a static comp. You get a lot of the answers when you're seeing it being built out. Mm-hmm. And then hopefully when you're working side by side with a developer and it's being implemented into a tech stack or CMS or whatever it may be, that, yes, there'll be issues that come up that you can start to answer on behalf of your client, or you might need to pause and get a client to come in and say, this is not going to actually work in this CMS, or it's not going to work in what the tech stack that we thought we were going to use, because the developer has chosen to use this tech stack that they're, you know, for Node, for example, that they're confident in using, but you had no idea how that actually works. I think it's bringing a client into the process and not being afraid of transparency. Some clients will balk if you say, I'm actually sending this offshore to a developer. Oh, why? Why are you doing that? I think it's a thing of saying, because I feel that they're stronger in producing this component of work than what I am. But at the end of the day, you don't have to worry about that. I'm managing them. It doesn't affect the cost. It's more responsibility on you as a designer. But you're learning as you go.
That's so close to home. It's the best designers that I have worked with are designers that have a strong understanding of how to build things in HTML and CSS. They understand how the columns and components are put together. And even then, you still have to keep reminding them that you need a mobile design as well. Mm-hmm. Or I'm going to build this mobile first. You've only given me desktop.
Mm.
What can I do to help you get the mobile design done?
Yeah.
And over time, the best designers I work with are either designers that I've built up the relationship with, and based on the designs, I can infer what they mean and how things will work because of the experience and the relationship I've built up with them, or designers where they've worked with enough developers to understand all of the different notes they need to stick on a design for interaction notes, for what to do when somebody hovers a button, what things move when a page resizes, does everything jump to specific breakpoints, or does everything reflow elastically. And they're things that can't always be inferred just by qualifications and technical skills.
Mm-hmm.
They're things that you can only get to know by working with a designer, things that you're completely blind to when you first go into it. And I don't think that design and development should be separated. We always have a policy of having designers and developers involved in the project foundation, the quoting process, scaffolding, coming up with designs, wireframes. All of those steps involve both designers and developers, project managers, because they're all involved in the final process, in the final production of whatever's coming out the other end. And there's going to be technical limitations that apply to all of the people along the way. You might have content developers that, copywriters that get to the end of the project and start to put in the copy and then realize that they want 15 menu items, not 14, and that completely breaks the layout.
Mm.
So one of the best things that I've also seen done is starting to break the projects down into smaller increments that can be deliverable, and not always just an increment that involves both copywriters, designers, and developers, but even just down into increments where you produce the content. And the content first based projects have always, I've always seen as the most successful ones, where you can produce the content, you can then look at what's involved in the design, and you have a much better idea of how long the design's then going to take. Then once the design is done, you can look at the development and you have a much better idea of how long the development's going to take. Those things, like, you can quote on them, but you have absolutely no idea what the final cost is going to be because you're trying to quote on something with your eyes closed.
Yeah. And there's a scary area there of queries and assumptions. And when a project comes in, whether it's in a agency environment, freelance environment, corporate environment, there's always queries and assumptions. And I think there's three golden rules that you can, if you can try and live by these three golden rules, most of the time you'll be okay. So the first one is always understanding what the business objectives are. What does the business want to get out of this project? Second, what's the user going to get out of it? You need to find a common ground between the business goals and the user goals. Third, you need to understand the content and how that's displayed in context. So it's always an issue of people or designers that design for lorem ipsum, because they always say, oh, we'll have a heading in here, we'll have a bit of body copy. But once the client or the copywriter starts to actually flesh that copy out, that layout may change, and it may change dramatically, which can help, which doesn't help, but it actually pushes out scope of work, cost, time. And then if you're having to pay for another developer in a freelance environment, so if you're outsourcing or a local dev and they've already tried to cost the job on a fixed rate, people start getting annoyed and pissed off. So I think if you can try and live by those three golden rules, and it doesn't have to be a certain order, but if you can understand the business goals, which you normally get from a client, they say, this is what I wanted to do. Then you need to help that client understand what users would want out of this. And then you need to help the client or the copywriter or a legal team try and work out the content before you actually start doing any design work. If we go back to how do you actually cost that project, it can be difficult. But I think a good client who's happy to invest time before they see a dollar figure on how much this is going to cost me, if you can sit down with them and tell them those golden rules before you give them a cost, help them in the ideation process of how this is all going to come about, you'll get a better outcome or happier client at the end, because there hasn't been so many reiterations. There hasn't been blowouts with scope of work. Timelines haven't been blown out because they've started at the very beginning. And a lot of agencies do bill for that process. They will charge with a client a cost to do a scope of work, depending on how big the agency is or how big the client is or how big the project is. And I think you need some sort of groundwork with a client before you even start talking about a dollar figure. It's that that saying of how long is a piece of string? I want a website. How much is it? Whoa, that's just incredible. Going on your topic of stories or breaking projects down into smaller chunks, if when you're working in Agile, that's definitely the best way to do it, as well as in production, of saying this is our big picture project or our big epic. We need to break these down into stories. And if you can tell a client that in a commercial environment, that we break everything down into stories, let them be a part of the process of seeing how a project's broken down. It gives you and them a bit more respect as well in terms of what you do as your craft. And if they can actually sit down and see how you do it, how your process works, if it's a fly on the wall or a Big Brother approach where they're just sitting there watching you go through this, I think they will start to respect your arguments further down the track. If you need to suggest a change or a hypothesis isn't working and you need to pivot on a project, they start to respect your craft a bit more.
Yeah, but then you're always fighting against all of the other small agencies out there that will just give a client a fixed price. Yeah, we can do that. And then that client, yeah, more often than not, that client gets pretty dissatisfied, which is why they're then shopping around. But they still end up going with somebody else with a fixed price. It is so hard to convey the importance to a client of the quality that they will get out the other end, which is why I used to tell so many clients just to go build a website in Squarespace. Make them do that first so they understand how much work is actually involved in writing content, in putting pages together, structuring things. And once they understand that, then it becomes a lot easier to talk to them about the process of making sure that the whole foundation is based on research and doing the research and discovery phases first.
Yeah.
And then scoping out the rest of the work.
Mm-hmm.
And making sure that it's based on the research, then the content, then the design, and then the development. And all departments need to be involved in all of the processes. Like, research isn't just a, you know, people looking up Wikipedia only.
Yeah.
It also involves developers looking up the analytics on that customer's existing site, working out where the majority of their traffic comes from. Is it local traffic? Is it international? Are they on mobiles? Are they on desktops?
Yeah.
What sort of age demographics are their clients? And working out how you can then craft and structure the content and messages in a way that's going to most benefit the problem the customer has that they've come to you for.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of it comes down to not always what the customer wants. They'll often come and ask you for a website or a logo. I need some new business cards. When their actual problem is very different from that. And a lot of customers don't, the clients don't like you trying to answer that for them. I want a website that everybody can order my courses online from.
Mm.
When in actual fact, they should be working out why people aren't taking their courses in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
Is it a problem with the courses or a problem with discoverability?
Yeah.
Or content material? Are they just not likable people? Do they have a bad message? Sometimes that's a very different problem from building a website.
Yeah. You get that a lot with e-commerce websites. People think, or clients think, that if they build a site to sell products online, people will come to it. And this happens, I think, a lot with small businesses.
If you build it, they will come.
If you build it, they will come.
Mm.
And half the time, it's the website's just a small component of their arsenal. And a lot of small businesses, yeah, think that if I build this site, I'll be able to sell online and I'll be making money while I sleep. And I just need to wake up the next day, package all the products and ship them off. But it's like you said, a lot of the times, well, before you run, let's walk. But before you walk, let's crawl. We need to start from the very beginning. And each project, I think, can be tackled in a different way to do that. Each industry can be tackled in a different way to do that. But as a designer, and this is where it's hard when you're starting out, there's a thing called ethics, and that you're...
Oh, this ethics thing.
Ethics. But it's being ethical in many different senses, but it's one of the things of saying, yeah, I can take your money, I can build you a website, or I can fix this website, I can improve it, I know I can, but I'm actually not really solving you a problem. Mm-hmm. And a lot of designers, when they start out, or developers, they do this, because at the end of the day, the reality is you need cash flow, you need income to pay the bills, to eat, to live. And that's okay, you can do that to start with, but there needs to become a point in your own ethical career where you say, I will do that, I'll still do that to pay the bills, to keep the lights on, but I need to actually start becoming a designer that solves problems. And I, yeah.
How much of the ethical side were you thinking about when you got into design? What was your choice? What influenced your choices to get into design work?
So I started as a print designer. That's what I started to do, a graphic designer.
Posters, business cards.
Yep. Brand, corporate identity, all that sort of stuff. And I was a bit naive at the time. I left university thinking, or I didn't leave university. I studied at a business college. So I learned a little bit of business alongside of graphic design. And I was naive when I left thinking, well, I can just go and work and just create logos and business cards and flyers and posters and get paid good money for this. It wasn't until I traveled and I came back and thought, okay, actually, I want to go to university now and hone this craft. And I was fortunate enough to study at two universities, the University of Canberra and the University of Newcastle for 1 year. And it opened my eyes. The University of Canberra was high on collaboration. The University of Newcastle had an importance of concept development, thinking and processes. So I got the insights of two worlds, basically. It wasn't until I finished at the University of Newcastle, that's when I worked out, okay, I want to get more into design. I was doing a lot of press ads, a lot of corporate identity. I need to move more into digital. So everything that I did was self-taught, because at the time of the universities, they weren't really teaching it. There was no such thing as UX. There was a thing called UX, but it was very early days. There was no, hey, this is how you build a website. This is how you design a website. If you wanted to learn that, you had to go and source that yourself through.
So how long ago was that?
2009, I graduated. So it was, that industry was there. Don't get me wrong, it was happening. The problem with large institutions is it's like any big moving beast, it takes time for them to catch up. So a lot of the stuff I learned was self-taught through just work experience or in a career or learning online, talking to other designers and developers. And then it was a part of my career where I said ethically, and yes, making stationery or just building a website, getting it on Squarespace or choosing a CMS to just quickly hack something together and get it done. It came a point where I thought to myself, and this is where I wanted to go into freelance, I need to start making a change. I need to start doing work that actually solves a business or an organization's problems, and then say to them, I can help get that big picture stuff done. The web is just one component of it. The reality is, when you're starting out, people don't perceive you that way. They see you as, oh, I need a website. I've been referred to you from another person. Can you help me build it? Mm-hmm. And that's where we go back to that topic of, sure, I'll take your money, give you a product. Yes, it will work. Yes, I can help get it built with my networking and my contacts, but I'm not really solving your problem.
Yeah.
So it's a really scary loop. And I think the real successful designers that people see at conferences and talks or creative directors of agencies, they're the ones that have said internally, and I don't quote me on this, but they could be the kind of people that say, no, we need to start designing for change. And now that you've built up that experience, you can, it's that argument of do the work that you want to do more work of. So if you do good work will come. If you do good work in a certain sector, you'll always pick up that sector. So for example, if you're always designing for the Aboriginal sector or the Indigenous sector of Australia, you'll pick up that work and you'll start to do really good work around that sector. But then how do you break out of that into something else? Mm.
Yeah. And part of it's also designing for the problem the customer has, not the problem the customer thinks they have.
Yes.
And that's where I see the successful designers. They're the people that see the problem that they're trying to solve rather than the design they're trying to generate, the design they're trying to produce. And like for me, when I started to get into development, I got into it not because there were amazing problems that I wanted to solve, but because there are amazing technologies I wanted to learn how to use.
Mm-hmm.
And I was taking projects based on, oh, what new technology can I use in this one? Oh, that will fit it. Okay, cool. So I can learn that on the job.
Okay.
Yeah, terrible idea. Do not do that.
Mm-hmm.
And it eventually turned into a very good experience though, because there's so many different fields that not just in development that I have an understanding of, but also in more esoteric fields. So a part of what I've learned in the past was production line management, logistics. I've worked in a restaurant preparing meals every day. How do you manage orders coming in? It turns out customers get really upset when you take somebody else's order after them and you give it to them first. So, you know, it may take 2 minutes for you to prepare the meal that's just come in an order while you're waiting for the other meals to cook on the stove, but you won't do that because it's going to upset the customers that have ordered first.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't matter whether you have that time to do it or not. What matters is the experience that the customers get. You can still delay and time that meal to come out straight after the other meals,
mm-hmm.
and then not break the flow of meals coming out and not upset the customers. And it's all about the customer experience. So they tend to, you know, you want your meal to be hot as soon as it comes out of the restaurant, mm-hmm. as soon as it hits your plate. Mm-hmm. So you need that person in the kitchen to be timing everything so that everything is prepared and ready to go just as it exits the kitchen.
Yeah.
And in the same way, in the design and development industry, you don't want to be putting too much work in early on and things going cold and stale and then having to redo them, you know, reheat things.
Mm.
You don't want to have to be designing everything with lorem ipsum and then the project come back to you later on with, oh, whoops, this heading needs to go over two lines.
Yes.
38 pixel line spacing isn't going to work there, sorry. Oh, this navigation needs to go across two lines, not one.
Mm.
These buttons don't stretch to the edges of the screen. Yeah, it's part of it's time management. Part of it's also having a really good crystal ball to be able to predict what the customer wants. And that only comes through experience and failure.
Yeah, yeah. Practice makes perfect.
Mm.
And I think the more you do it, so if we say customer is client or a customer using a product, I think the more you do it, the more you can start to predict pitfalls. And it's just through experience. A lot of designers, and this could be the same with developers, that they are afraid to fail. And when you're working in an agency or corporate environment, there's that pressure on you to not fail. Some agencies could, or in corporate environments, it's pretty much we've employed you because of your specific skill set. We kind of can't afford to have you fail because it's affecting a project, it's affecting other team members.
Mm.
But I think it's a good, if you're lucky enough to work in an environment that endorses or celebrates failure, then gee, never leave that job. But I think when you're working as a freelancer and you have failure, you need to embrace it. Yes, it means you may need to, the cost of the job might go down. Like, you might not make as much out of that job, but you'll learn something from it. If a developer fails and you have to pick up the pieces and learn it on the fly, that's good, because everything you learn, you'll take through your life experiences, whether that's from something that you've learned in a part-time job that's outside of the creative industries to what you've learned inside of the creative industries. You'll always learn something through to failure. And when I lectured at the university for about a year and a half, that was something that we tried to get across to students, that this is your chance to fail. And it's not all about the marks at the end of the day. Yes, the marks give you a piece of paper which says you have a bachelor's or you have something in a master's in design. But fail. This is the best chance to fail. And you're not going to be penalized for it. I think it's that thing of if you fail but you've shown your processes and you've shown that you've tried, you'll probably get a better mark than someone that just smashed this project out of the park and that never showed their processes. They just turned up with the solution and the product.
Mm-hmm.
If you can also continue to fail in your career and try new things and become, I don't like this word innovative. Everybody's saying that they're innovative, but at the end of the day, 90% of people are just sheep. We're following somebody else carving the trail. But if you can sort of have that notion of I'm trying to be innovative, I'm trying something different. Yes, 20 of these concepts or something are failing. And I know I need to deliver this final outcome for this client in a freelance environment, but I've tried something new. I haven't been afraid to fail. And if it works, then pour a glass of scotch and celebrate and let the world know that you tried and this is the outcome that happened. And I think that if you're someone that's listening to this and you're at a university level or you're studying or you're about to come into the industry or you're thinking, do I go freelance or agency? You know, everyone's got their different prerogatives. But I think if you can take into it that I'm not going to be afraid to fail, I think you'll go a lot further in your career. And we do it all the time with, as a user experience designer, you need to fail. That your hypothesis needs to be challenged. If you say, okay, the business objectives is this, I guesstimate that the clients or the user experience, what they need to get is this, and this could be apples and oranges, and you're trying to gel a banana out of the two of them, that when you actually get it in front of a user to test, if it fails, that's good. That's really good. That's what you want. You don't always want. It's validating your hypothesis. And if you work in an organization or an agency that celebrates that, that says, yeah, let's try it. Let's A-B test something. Let's just give it a go. One of them's going to fail. You can't have two winners.
That's the whole point of A-B testing.
That's the whole point.
Something is going to fail.
Yeah.
And if something's not failing, then you're doing something wrong.
Exactly. And that goes, so if we backpedal to the start of this conversation, when I was looking at moving away from freelance back into a full-time role, I was very skeptical of all the jobs that came across, all the referrals that came across, and I did a lot of research into, so research is online and talking to people about these certain positions that came that would come through. And I'd always challenge, does this agency reiterate? Do they test? Are they afraid of failure? Because if they are, I'm not going anywhere near them from past experiences. And mm-hmm. It goes back to what you said. You don't want to join an environment where you're a computer monkey. There's a whip that's being cracked over your back just to get that design out, get it done well, send it out, and we'll never see it again. The reality is that does happen. It's that cash flow thing. We've got to pay people, keep the lights on. But if an agency can endorse or celebrate failure, reiteration, having a client on board in the process, teamwork, then that's the place that you need to be.
Did you find that looking at jobs between agencies and corporate environments, there was a difference in the embracing of failure? So I get the feeling that a lot of agencies are very afraid of failure because they have clients to impress.
Yeah.
And they don't want to be seen as losing face in front of clients.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I completely agree. So a lot of the ones I looked at, and this is not just Newcastle-based, this is also Sydney and Melbourne-based that I was looking at, that there is a perception of agencies, yes, they need to keep up a reputation. It's seen as though everybody that employs here is perfect at their craft. They know what they're doing. And account managers sometimes sell this, or business owners sell this.
We want somebody with 10 years sketch experience.
That's right. So job descriptions really annoy me. They're a pet hate. It's this thing of... So I'm going through a thing at the moment where it's... And you see it in a lot of jobs descriptions. We want a designer. We want a graphic designer. A graphic designer that understands print production, print process, HTML and CSS and JavaScript and WordPress and Joomla and this and that and this. Oh, and they need to know Git. It's like, hold on a second. Yes, there is a title that I believe once existed called a multi-purpose designer, but that doesn't exist anymore. And I think if you ever see or through the channels, you hear of an agency or a studio that says, we want a graphic designer that's a master of all, a jack of all, a master of none, you just don't even go anywhere near them. I think that, it's happening in this industry that, so I'm a UX designer, and every designer and developer is a UX designer. A good developer is always thinking, if a designer has missed something, a good developer should be able to say, hold on, when a user clicks or taps this and we need to display this content, is the way the designer suggests the best way in terms of development? Can I do this something that's A, easier for me to implement, and B, would actually have a better result? So I think that with titles, if we go back to titles, a UX designer is also a UI designer, and here comes the people throwing stones at me. I can hear them at the door. But basically, I believe a UX designer is a UI designer. A UX and UI designer is an IXD or interaction designer. A UX designer is a UX, UI, IXD, maybe a bit of front end in terms of HTML and CSS. But I'm only saying that because when you freelance, you have to do all that. You have to wear all those hats. And then on top of that, you've got to project manage, you've got to bill, you've got to run a business.
I think the experience of both being, having been freelance and having experienced the agency or corporate lifestyle is very valuable to anybody in the industry. I'd even recommend people go straight into agency or corporate work straight out of uni and try out freelance as well. Because unless you've tried both, you don't understand the pressures that both can bring. And they are different pressures. And so UX is always a controversial topic. You're always going to get somebody who disagrees with you. Before I'd heard the term UX, 5 or so years ago when I was first getting business cards printed, I knew that I was going to be made redundant soon. So I was starting to plan for that. And business cards just said, Carl Bowden, Internet Experience Engineer. I know that the word engineer is just as controversial, but the point was that I knew that I wasn't a designer. I'd gone through enough red buttons with blue borders with green writing that I knew that I did not belong anywhere near a colour picker.
Yeah.
That my job was purely just to implement the designs. But at the same time, I knew that you couldn't differentiate just based on I can do development. There's so many people in the world that can develop, but having a personality and an interaction and making the designer feel at ease, presenting them a level of knowledge where you understand what they're trying to design and you can build that in a way that is going to make the customer happy is where the value lies, because that implies that you have a certain level of experience in understanding how customers think.
Yeah.
And the more that I moved along with it, the more I realized that that wasn't unique to development or design. That was something that I really didn't, that title didn't belong to me. It was a title that was something that everybody in the industry should have. Whether you're a designer, a developer, a copywriter, everybody is trying to work to understand the client and solve the problems that the client has. But the difference is that the title UX, that you're designing an experience and that you're understanding the experience, is that particular to those words is failure. That you have to have the ability to either A-B test to come up with possibilities where one of them is going to fail, or you come up with one design and that one design may or may not fail, which is a much scarier outcome.
Yeah.
Having only one design where you are not guaranteed success is very different from a design where there are two possible outcomes where one of them is success. When you have that point, you have a design that is guaranteed to have the possibility of more success than another design. Whereas when you're just having one design, you're guaranteed to have the possibility of success or no success, which is not a guarantee at all.
Yeah.
And you know, internet experience design, people really got the wrong impression of it. You know, they were thinking, I've got a 56K modem, and am I going to get a better experience if I put in an ADSL connection? That wasn't quite what I was intending, even though that's how people interpreted it. It was a very naive wording of UX.
Mm.
But that was, and was also that I didn't understand the importance of failure at the time as well. And it feels like failure is the most important part to UX.
Yeah. I think UX is a really good place to fail, because that's what your job is to test hypotheses, to test scenarios. And it's a good title to have, to be able to blow back or push back on why something failed, because that's your job. That's what you're supposed to do, is to deliver the best outcome, to test different scenarios and to see which works, which sticks. You don't really get that luxury in a fast-paced environment. Sometimes you don't get that luxury in a corporate environment. For a UX designer, user testing can be anything from, if you have a digital product, industrial designers, for example, if you have a physical product, taking something to your local coffee shop, tapping somebody on the shoulder, saying, I'll buy you a cup of coffee if you can just tap around on this device for a while and let me just watch you. Any designer should be able to do that. You don't need to be a UX designer to do it. If you're a freelancer, if you're in an agency, you should be allowed to do that. If you're in this is probably the beautiful thing about a co-working space too, is that if you work in an agency that's in a co-working space, or if you're a freelancer in a co-working space, you're normally working in an environment where there are other creatives, but they don't know the project you're working on.
Yeah.
And you've already got that relationship where you know their name, you know what they do, that you should be able to take the digital product that you've made, walk up to that photographer that's sitting four desks away and say to them, hey, Joe, can I just interrupt you for 5 minutes? I just want to see how you behave when you're using this app, or if you're using this website. But it's not sort of saying use the whole thing. You need to break that project into a story and say, I want to see how you sign up. I want to see how you think you log in to this digital product. Give them a bit of a background. Say this is a social media application. It links 5 social channels into one area. But the first thing you need to do is sign up. Have a go and watch them. Any designer should be able to do that. Any developer should be able to do that. Just take it to a coffee shop and say to the barista, hey, can you just pretend to log in for me on this app and see how they behave with it? Any agency that encourages or embraces that practice, they're the ones I think you need to go and get a job at.
And it's okay to be completely nervous about that experience as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Whether you are a UX person or not, it doesn't discount the amount of nerves you're going to have. You are taking something to somebody and expecting them to, that you've designed something that they are going to be able to use, and you're scared that they're not going to be able to use it.
Yeah.
That is nerves. Plus, you know, social awkwardness, everything else on top of that, all counts towards nerves. But having the feedback, seeing somebody actually use it and fail or succeed at it, seeing where they pause before they tap a button.
Mm.
Yeah, maybe okay is not a good a word. It's not a better word.
Yeah.
It's not a something word as, yeah, maybe log in or join now or sign me up for free. Yeah, they might have a hesitation in pressing a button that only has an outline versus a button that's filled in.
Mm.
Those are all things that it's okay to fail at. And it's also okay to be nervous about failing at as well.
Mm-hmm.
Just because you call yourself a UX designer doesn't mean that you have to accept failure any better than anybody else.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yeah. So getting back to merging designers and developers.
Yes.
I know that you have a fairly good understanding of HTML and CSS.
Mm-hmm. I like to think so-ish. Yeah,
I know that you do, whether you admit it or not. So I've found that invaluable as a designer. I'm a developer. I found that invaluable as a developer.
You're a designer and developer.
No, I'm a designer developer who knows that I'm not a designer.
It's a good approach. It's a good outlook. Yeah.
I'm a designer developer who knows that I'm only doing development because I am so fucking awful at design.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I could A/B test the shit out of it, but yep. That's somebody else's job who knows so much more about it. I realized this very early on. which is why I then just started doing development. And because computers don't argue with me as much as people do. They might disagree with me, but they don't argue.
And you can get a workaround to make them agree with you, a computer, I suppose.
Yeah.
I could be wrong.
You just keep hitting it with a hammer until it does agree with you.
Yeah.
Just keep trying to work out what the spelling mistake is you've made this time.
Yeah.
Now, as a developer, I really value the designs. When I'm working with a designer initially, the designs they produce, if they have a good understanding of HTML and CSS, makes the development process a lot easier.
Mm.
But at the same time, I know that not every designer is going to have that experience. So I struggle with what I can do to make that experience easier for designers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what can I do to make it easier for them to give me designs that are going to be closer to what they think they should be? And in the past, I've tried tools like Macaw, Reflow, Webflow, and tried to get them to even use projects where they can use the inspector tools and have the project fired up in the terminal using Gulp and change things as they're going,
mm-hmm.
so they can see the changes live on the website as they want to make the changes.
Mm-hmm.
But I've not found anything better than actually grabbing a designer, sitting them down beside me, and them pointing things out on the screen,
mm-hmm.
and me making the changes as they're describing them. Because as they're going through things, it's so easy to miss things and not put them down in writing as you're going through them. Like, they might be going through and they look at a website and they think, oh, the developer hasn't made the font size correct, it should be 12 pixels. But as they're going through, they might forget that the line height is also too high as well, and that should be decreased, not just in proportion, but also in actual line height as well.
Mm.
And then that has to go back for another revision after you've made the changes. It's then got to come back and they've noted that you've missed the line height as well. Those things, it almost feels like everybody should be a designer developer.
Yep.
And yet I know the frustration that trying to cover all of those bases causes.
Yep.
And I don't know where the line is to draw, where how much development should a designer learn? How much design should a developer learn? Is the best designer somebody who's come from a development background?
So I was talking about this same scenario to a couple of other designers, and my question was, how much control do you want? As a designer, how much control do you want? And that'll answer how much time you need to invest in learning a new tool or understanding how something is built. Because I think the more you understand, the more control you have. So I think the problem is with a lot of designers, and I'm once again guilty as charged in my early days, is that you would always say, oh, here, so this is before mobile first, to paint a picture. You would always go, oh, here's the desktop site. Here's the mobile site. Developer, you come up with what's in the middle. And once again, guilty as charged, you'd get it, they would throw it back over the fence. You'd look at it and go, that's not what I wanted. But the problem is, just like a client, you don't know what you want until you see it. But as a designer, you've got to invest that time of what you want to see. You can't leave it up to a developer to answer all the questions. You need to start doing some of the legwork as well. And it comes back to that thing of control. So I think, okay, my ideal setup in terms of work process would be, and this is the same for an agency or a corporate environment or freelancing, I think it would be, you get the client in at the very beginning. Simple as that, or the customer or the stakeholder. You do the ideas sort of phase, you map everything out, the business objectives, you sketch it out, you have a sketch session, you get everybody involved, you start sort of spitballing some style tiles so that they can understand UI components if it's a new brand or something existing that you need to reiterate on. Then you can move into a wireframe to get them to understand how structural components work. Then you kind of skip the high fidelity Photoshop, Sketch, Illustrator, whatever you want to use, Fireworks. Then you start looking at how you can build that into a browser environment. This is where some designers go, I'm scared because it's unknown territory.
New tools.
Mm-hmm. But I want full control. I want it to be what I envision on behalf of the client and the user to be what a developer would do. And this is where they kind of get a bit scared because I think, A, it's something new that I have to learn. B, it's outside of my job description. C, there's just not enough hours in the day on top of my normal workload. But if you want full control, you're going to have to squeeze more hours out of the day to learn. This is how a gutter works. This is what a margin is inside of a, with the columns. Mm-hmm. You need to understand that, a developer has used a class here for this paragraph text, which has, and if they had font size 12 pixels, I would cry. But if they had font size 16 pixels with a certain line height, that same class is used somewhere else. So if you're starting to change in the browser some of the design and it's affecting something else, you need to understand why. But a lot of designers don't go into that territory because it's unknown. So in the ideal setup, it would be, everything's agreed upon, wireframes, style tiles, everything's signed off. Now we're going to design in browser. And whether that's taking the style tiles and the wireframes and working alongside a developer, yes, it's a bit more time consuming, but you save with reiterations and throwing things over the fence. And in inviting a client in on that process, I think is really important so they can see how that works and they're a bit more mindful and respectful of time, changes, all that sort of stuff. And it gets them understanding that, when I have to start producing content, if you haven't got any content at the beginning, I understand how it's going to work in an online environment. So as a designer, you would start to use tools like Macore and Reflow and Webflow and all those sort of ones that you can build online or design in the browser are helpful, I think, in just streamlining a process. They're not a part of the puzzle or a piece of the puzzle that should go into the final picture. It's just something to help you speed up your process. And I think while you're learning that tool, you're learning in a nice GUI or graphic user interface environment how things are built. So like we were talking about previously before we started recording, a designer, yes, it's hard to say, so what the hell is position absolute and position relative? You don't really know until you start having a go and not being afraid to fail. And I think once you can start to do that, yes, the tools will probably dictate and limit your design, but the more you practice with that certain craft, the more you can empathize with the developer and the more you can understand how to push the boundaries. So I've had projects in the past that have come from mainly print design agencies or designers, and they want to do something groundbreaking, but they don't really understand the technologies, the time involved to get to that point.
So Macore, Reflow, Webflow,
mm-hmm.
I'd argue that they're disastrous to a designer.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Every design that I've received that has been done through one of those tools has only caused the designer more frustration because it doesn't actually teach them anything about the development of HTML and CSS. It's a tool to implement HTML and CSS, not to learn and translate designs.
Mm-hmm.
It's much more valuable to teach a designer how to do table-based layout rather than give them a tool that they can do responsive layout in, because at least then they understand how positioning and content flow works.
Yeah.
Whereas if you give them a tool that is going to give them something closer to what the designer would produce, it might be valuable to a designer, but it's not going to teach them unless they do a lot of training or courses on that process. I know that you were a very big proponent of the online courses, Code School, Treehouse.
Yep.
And that, I think, is a much more valuable process for any designer.
Mm-hmm.
To go and learn basic HTML and CSS skills, even to the point where they are actually producing and coding in the browser their designs. Because at least then they understand the actual limitations of the browser. And there is a certain degree where the process of learning HTML and CSS has a detrimental effect on the designs that they produce.
Okay. So what you're saying is,
don't give me designs in HTML and CSS. I'm happy for somebody to give me completely flat PNGs, JPEGs, I don't care if they're JPEGs. Mm-hmm. I just want those people to either have a very good understanding of HTML and CSS,
yeah,
or none at all.
Okay. All right. Yeah.
They might have been a Flash designer in the past.
Yeah.
And it wouldn't be pretty, but they would have a good understanding of how animations work and how tweening and positioning and vectorization works when you're enlarging things.
So do you feel if a designer was to pick up, let's just pick one off the shelf, let's say if they were to pick up Macaw, they, yes, it's a nice, I suppose, way to introduce them. It's a different way of introducing a designer into the markup world, but they're doing it in a way of a drag and drop approach and not seeing how things are happening behind the scenes. So they're not really learning how it's being built. They're just building it in a nice GUI format.
Yeah.
Whereas you're probably saying, no, let's start with a blank slate, teach them the fundamentals, how HTML, CSS are connected, for example, and then letting them see that come out on the page. So they're more learning about how it's built and the final output instead of this is final output, now learn how it was built.
I'd be much happier if they gave me HTML components,
okay,
as elements that I can then build. So a button and some way of showing me how that button reacts to different content widths. Is this button meant to just align to the right-hand side of a column? Is it meant to align to the right-hand side of the text of the column? Or is it meant to align to the right-hand side of the gutter of the column?
Ah, okay. Yeah.
Those sort of things tell me so much more about the design that they're trying to build.
Sure.
Whereas actually building a whole design altogether, I think, detracts from the individual components that they're trying to produce. Mm-hmm. They're trying to put everything together in a way that visually looks good.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the individual components, they tend to start to forget about how each of those components is put together and how each of those components should react to different screen sizes, different content sizes.
Yep. So it's more of saying, here is a style tile that has been marked up, essentially. Because we know that style tiles are just visual, basically style guides of core assets, color palettes, typography, button states, all that sort of stuff. This is kind of taking a style tile from a static environment to a markup environment. So the designer can say, yes, this button on desktop, I know how this should behave on mobile, and now I know how it should behave on tablet. But they're not just going, here's a mock-up for desktop, tablet, mobile. They're also saying, I now understand how that button should transition between the two environments.
Yeah.
So it's more of a markup style tile instead of a static style tile.
And that markup is not just between mobile and desktop, for example, but it's also between different column and content widths.
Mm-hmm.
So a button might be a maximum of 250 pixels wide.
Yeah.
Or a minimum, for example. Probably a better example. But, and that button may change between desktop and mobile, but desktop and mobile may have absolutely no influence on that button size. It might be purely influenced by the column size rather than the actual screen that they're viewing it on.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And it also affects the way the content is displayed to a user.
Mm-hmm.
So viewing something in landscape versus portrait can also affect the way that a user is expecting to interact with the content.
Mm.
If you have a form that you suddenly turn sideways on a mobile and somebody taps in a field and opens the keyboard, you're suddenly only going to see a very limited amount of content around that field.
Mm.
And it's so common that it's so disheartening when you see so many mobile forms that you tap on and you turn into landscape mode so that you can type really quick because mm-hmm. you've got nice large buttons that you know that you're not going to miss. And you can't see the label describing the field that you're in. So next, you fill in that field, like you might understand the field that you've tapped in, and then you hit next. And the next field doesn't have a label
Placeholder's gone. Yeah.
And you don't know what the hell you're meant to be typing in that thing.
Okay.
It's more about both the height, the width, and the content that it's inside of, the context that you're trying to design for, rather than is this a mobile or is this a desktop?
Mm. So that's something you're saying a designer should obviously have worked out or work with a developer to work out?
No, it's something that is core and fundamental to user experience.
Mm.
It's not something that's particular to design or development or to both. It's something that's particular to the context that a user is in.
Yeah.
If a user is not able to go between different contexts and understand where they're moving from and to, then as soon as you've done that, you're introducing frustration and resistance to the user, and that's what causes the user to drop off. I mean, it's very similar to e-commerce, where if you are forcing users to add things to their cart and then go to checkout and then type in their postcode and then see how much postage is going to cost, You're introducing frustrations. As soon as you introduce products to your catalog, you might attach prices to them. You might include shipping inside that price. But as soon as you introduce just the picture, just the description, and nothing else, you're forcing the user to have questions that are unanswered about that product. A TV. So I see a TV on an e-commerce website and I want to know how large the bezel is around the TV. If that's not answered on that website, I have to go somewhere else to find that information.
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as I've gone somewhere else, they've lost me as a customer.
Yeah.
So much of it is about not losing the customer by keeping the context understandable and answering the questions that the customer has. And that relates so much to design and development as well, where a designer wants to give the developer a design that developer knows how to implement, because every question that a designer, a developer, a content, a copywriter has to ask is more delays and more frustration for that person, and the more they're going to get sidetracked from the actual task.
Mm-hmm.
The largest amount of delays that I've ever had in projects is where I've had to ask questions about a design.
Yep.
That feedback process that not just introduces delays, but introduces frustration and changes the mental attitude that somebody has when they're in that process. It makes them frustrated and not want to finish the development, the design.
Mm.
You might be designing something and you have no idea whether headlines should be limited to one line or should span multiple lines, whether they're going to have two elements in the navigation bar, whether they're going to have 100. How do you structure a menu that has 100? Should everything be nested and sub-nested? Mm-hmm. Should everything show, you know, four levels of deep nesting when you hover each item? Those sort of things introduce so much frustration to the process, where the more things that can be answered and the less questions you have to ask, the easier the process goes.
So how do you get those answers to come to fruition?
A lot of it is experience and failure.
Yeah.
Core to UX, you have to learn how to fail.
Yeah.
And learning how to ask those questions, what the frustration and the pain points are for designers when you keep asking them all these questions.
Mm.
Where are the mobile designs? And eventually they're going to learn that they need to give you mobile designs so that you stop asking.
So it's kind of, a UX for a designer.
But it's not always giving you mobile designs. Sometimes all that's needed is instructions on how a fluid design should flow when a page is resized.
So that's the problem that I think we're facing here is you've mentioned you're happy for a designer to give you static comps and then to work alongside, so almost pairing. And so you would take a comp, build it out, bring it up on a browser, and then have the designer sit next to you and kind of fine-tune and tweak. So we're talking about collaboration process here. But if you're saying, okay, designer, give me mobile, give me mobile, give me mobile on every single project, and then they start giving you mobile, then we're moving to that area of, but what happens between? What happens when a user turns at landscape and the placeholders disappear on this form field?
Yeah.
Now a designer is starting to think about almost the UX, not just for the customer, but the UX for a developer. Like, how does the developer experience the development process?
But so, doesn't answering the questions for the developer also answer the questions for the customer as well?
Yeah. There's things that can be missed or forgotten when you're kind of going, okay, this is how a static comp should look. It's gone through testing. The user can't tap or click, if it's desktop, on this input field. We're just kind of letting them know that if they click or tap here, that this will happen. But then when the designer is sitting next to a developer and you currently flip your simulator to landscape or your testing device to landscape, and you see that happen, and a developer goes, Chris, what's going to happen here? The designer kind of has to think then on the fly.
Chris, why you no like mobile?
That's right. Even though you've said, hey, give me a mobile design, give me the mobile concept, you think, I have.
And yes, then it shrinks to 320 pixels wide.
Yes.
And then all your text gets truncated because you haven't given me the designs for it. And then you get frustrated. And then, Chris, why you no like mobile?
So this goes back to the argument of when does. So this goes back to the argument of titles. Where do you stop? So a UX, like I said, has to basically do. So anyone that's listening, before they do throw stones, like I said before, in maybe a Fortune 500 company, yes, you will have a dedicated UX. Let them throw stones. You shouldn't be afraid to have a stone hit you. But in a Fortune 500 or a large organization, you might be fortunate, well, you should be fortunate enough to have a UX designer, a UI designer, an interaction designer, a couple of feds, a couple of backends, et cetera, et cetera. But if you're in an agency environment or a freelance environment or a small corporate environment, I see it, a UX designer has to do UI because there's nobody else. A UI designer then with the UX kind of has to understand IXD or interaction design. But then a Fed needs to understand interaction design. They need to know that, okay, so when a user changes the orientation of this mobile device, that's an interaction that's like it's happening. How do we display that? Yes, we have a button. When a user taps this button or clicks this in a desktop environment and they're uploading a file, how do we display that information? A UX designer needs to probably pick that up earlier on when they're then going to annotate that to a developer. So the problem we're facing is, where do titles begin and end? Where does handoff begin and end, or actually end? So when I'm giving, say for example, we're working on a project and I'm giving you static comps, we're moving that, you're building it out into a browser and we're kind of doing QA as we go on the fly. And you're picking up all these points. Like you said, if something changes to landscape and the placeholder disappears on a form when they go to the next form field, should the designer have picked that up in the beginning? Yes, it comes with experience. They probably will pick that up. But then the developer might always just have the same answer on how that should behave, because a form field's a form field. I think no matter what environment it's in, the challenge is where do you draw the line? And if we go back to the root of this argument or conversation, it's more...
Argument.
Let's do arguments, because they're more invigorating than a conversation.
Because you're wrong.
Everyone's wrong and everybody's right. But it's saying, okay, here's a static design. In QA, we've picked some of this up. Or in development, we've picked some of this up. But as a designer, should I use a different tool to help illustrate or argue that? And sometimes just learning how to build something out in Coda or Sublime and then seeing it push out through Gulp into a browser and learning how to do that is okay. But that probably will take a bit more time than a designer going, here's something I've made in Macaw. It's not
perfectly fleshed out.
It's not gospel. It is what it is. But this is how I, as a designer, think it should play out.
It's a perception of ideas.
Yeah. It's the best way that I can paint a roadmap for then hopefully you to pick up more pieces than you would from a static comp to take into a build environment. I think that's the challenge that some agencies on a certain scale, some corporations on a certain scale, are struggling to do.
What I hear you saying, though, is that front-end designers, as soon as they have to ask questions, send some... it's not so much ask questions. It's I receive a design, I implement it, I send it back to the designer. As soon as the designer has to ask questions or send me back revisions, those revisions are things that I should have been asking earlier. They're things that I should have been catching and things that I failed at. And it's partly the tools that we use, that there's no way to portray that, you know, the implication of what happens when somebody hovers a button. What happens when the screen shrinks or what happens if you've activated the keyboard and then you rotate the landscape? There's no way of imparting every single possibility. Part of it is the relationship between the designer and the developer. So much of it falls down to not having good tools to answer all of the questions that everybody needs. And it's not necessarily the designer's fault. If things come back for revisions, half the time it's also the developer not building what the designer wants, but also not because the designer didn't give them what they need, but because they have no way of portraying what they need to the developer.
Yeah.
And I don't have a good answer for that, other than everybody's wrong. And, you know, it's UX. Part of it is understanding how people work, how they use things, and understanding the situations and the common questions that get asked. And until you get to that point, you're going to go through so many different scenarios and get so many questions asked of you that you need to suffer all of those things to be able to get to the point where you understand it in a way that you can answer those questions without having to ask them.
Yeah. And I think the challenge that would happen in a corporate environment, to throw a spanner in the works, if a team dynamics change, say somebody leaves or they move into a different area, standardization, not just in terms of UI patterns or anything, UI libraries like that, you kind of need to look at the higher level that standardization needs to happen then across teams. In an agency environment, and you could correct me because you're in this world, but obviously everybody after a while starts to understand how each other work, and you know how much you need to give and how much that other person needs to give back to make a project successful. And because, you know, there's obviously always turnover in an agency environment, but let's say you're working in an agency that has 20 staff and a designer and a developer are working together on a project, you know that next time you'll be working with that same developer. In a corporate environment, if somebody leaves or teams change in an agile environment, let's say, it's then kind of relearning how to ride that bike without the training wheels. So I think as a designer, especially as a UX designer, you're always empathetic about the customer. Mm-hmm. You're always empathetic about the client, which is the business, for example. But you need to be empathetic about the developer. And if you've built up a really good rapport with a developer and they leave or they change a team, then you think, shit, I've got to start from scratch now. But everything you may have learned and you may have streamlined your process working with that developer may not work for the next developer. So as a designer, it is time consuming. It is a lot of energy. It's a lot of effort. But I think you need to learn or understand or appreciate more of how things are built, how things are constructed in terms of markup. So when a new developer comes on board or you're sitting down with a new team member, when they start throwing out sayings or abbreviations, you kind of know what they're talking about. So I don't think every designer should know how to build. They should understand the fundamentals so that when they switch from a designer's hat to talking with a Fed or a developer, they know what they're talking about. And I think in an ideal world, if you could do concepts, maybe a bit of markup on your own, like we said, interactive style tiles, if we want to put a title on it, then when you're sitting down with a developer, they've got all the cookie cutter pieces they need to then make your layout. And if you can then sit with them on a refinement stage or a quality assurance stage and just do some tweaking, hey, that's the best outcome. You don't need to build everything. So I think what we've gotten out of this is maybe that's something that we could look at in a corporate and an agency environment. Maybe the designer needs to start building buttons. Maybe they need to start using some sketch plugins to do interaction design. Yes, in a corporate environment, you may be a UX designer. That's your title. But in reality, you need to be a UI and an interaction designer as well. Because when you're then liaising with a developer, they need to know those answers to those questions that they're going to come up with. But a good designer, I think, can preempt those questions and already have those answers. They don't need to present them straight away, because it's that thing of, if you're working with a new team member, you go, okay, I know that when this form, when I rotate the device, the form, the placeholders will disappear and the keyboard will display. Maybe I don't want to tell the developer the answer. Maybe I want to see how the developer comes up with that answer.
Fuck you.
And that's okay. Start the stone throwing. But then as a good designer, yes, you're having to make that person think, and that developer's going, shit, this guy doesn't just give me the answers on a silver platter, but you're challenging them, but in a safe and friendly environment of a workplace. But then you're able to say, okay, they've come up with something that I haven't thought about. This is what I thought about. Let's find a common ground. But straight away, I've learned something about that new team member that I was just comfortable with that previous team member. I think the biggest problem is there's no bloody playbook. There's no golden rule. There's no blog, website, book that's been written that I know of that says this is how you should do it. It's all just through experience.
There's lots of things that have been written, so many things that are valuable, but not something that applies to everybody.
Mm.
And there isn't anything that's going to apply to everybody, which is what makes it so hard.
Yeah.
And like, nobody expects everything to apply to them, which is okay. Nobody should expect everything to apply to them. And like, at the same time, it's still the rounds of revisions, a lot of time, are still things that should have been raised earlier.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that revision rounds are a detrimental thing. But at the same time, it's still a learning process of what you should be taking care of earlier.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's partly it's because of things that designers, developers haven't learned, but also partly it's because of lack of experience with interacting with that person. And that's something that can only be built up over time, over experience.
Yeah.
And until you get to that point, nobody can answer those questions for you. It's okay to ask them. There's no such thing as a bad question.
Just a silly one.
Even a silly question. Why has that person asked it in the first place? Have you done something wrong? It's not their fault that they've had to ask the question. The only thing worse than that is somebody who doesn't ask the question. Somebody who just does something because they don't want to ask the question. Not because, like, there's a difference between thinking that you're doing something because it's the right thing,
yeah,
versus doing something because you want to avoid losing face. And that's a very difficult thing to let go of to become a good designer or developer. Losing face is, it costs you drinks at the pub. Nobody wants to buy you a drink because you feel that you are less than other people. You feel that because you've had to ask questions that you don't, that you're not on the same level as other people, when that is actually the key to making you a good designer, a good developer, a good person, understanding people, being able to know when you have to ask questions. And the only way you're going to learn that is by asking the questions.
So asking you a question, I know we're role reversing now, but in an ideal scenario, How would you like a project? And I know I've worked with you in the past, and some of the projects, let's just say, were rocky ground in terms of how they began.
That'd be polite.
That'll be the polite way. But in an ideal world, how would you like to receive a project from a designer?
With a bottle of scotch. And
so, to paint a bit of a timeline,
almost fully formed. So as much interaction design as I can have, the better.
Yeah.
It's easy to take static mock-ups and implement them into static designs. I mean, I could just take a screenshot and set that as the background image of a web page, and then I'd be done. But as soon as you start wanting somebody to be able to click a button for a form to then slide down, for the image to start growing in the background every time somebody hovers it, for an image to fade to grey when they hover it, there don't seem to be any good tools that are easy for both designers and developers to understand where you can portray that type of interaction to them.
So on that, when you say you ideally you'd like a designer to think about all the interaction design, and you've said that there's not really a tool that can let a designer put forward basically, hey, I want it to look exactly like this. And I'm guilty of this as well. We've always looked at online resources and said, kind of like this. Can you make it fade in like this, but then do this?
I know you're one of the biggest proponents of Envision, and I admire you for that, even though I had Envision.
Yeah.
Not because the company is bad or the products are bad, just because I feel that the mock-ups don't go far enough.
I
would love it if Envision reached through the screen and punched me in the face and told me how a button should animate between different views.
So on Envision's behalf, and it's funny because 2 days ago I tweeted them saying, where the hell is motion? You've been promising this thing. And when I was at university lecturing, I was fortunate enough to introduce some second year students to Atomic. Now, it's not Atomic in terms of the tech, it's in Atomic.io, which is a prototyping tool, but it seems to be more focused around on designing in the browser, but understanding interaction design. So he's a big follower of Google design, not just their material, but their actual principles of how people interact with an application.
I can agree on that.
You can kind of achieve that in Atomic. So the problem I'm facing at the moment, we've talked about all these different tools. We've talked about markup tools, communication tools, like how the best way to do it is sitting down together. But maybe it's something that a designer needs to go, the tools to win this war, I'm going to need a lot of them to get my case across because I want full control. So but not full control in terms of a selfish level. It's full control of being able to articulate what I'm trying to get across, and sometimes words don't always mean that or get that through. So you might have to say, okay, Envision shows me how, basically Envision can show me how to, or show a user or a developer the sequence. They don't really be able to nest down in terms of the interaction design. So yes, when a user holds on this button with their finger, what should happen? Google's kind of got that sorted. If you look at Google design principles, Atomic can kind of let you do that. So I think the problem is designers now, you can't just rely on a static comp with a whole bunch of documentation and a developer just to be able to go, I get what you mean in terms of this fades in. But a good designer should be able to say, this doesn't fade in, it has a transition. And it has an ease, and it's this many milliseconds, because they can know, they should have a good understanding or grasp of how a developer would need to build that. And I think a lot of designers get lost in translation. They always say, on this mobile device, when someone clicks, no, it's when someone taps. But if someone taps and holds, what should happen? And a good designer through experience should be able to say, sure, developer, when someone taps and holds, this happens. And what we've worked out is if it's a style tile that has all those interactions in it, it should already be sorted out. So we're trying to make a I think for me as a designer in a corporate environment, I'm trying to make a developer's life easier, because there's a lot more pressure that a lot of designers don't see, that a developer and a full stack as you are, that you have to deal. You have to deal with servers. You have to deal with certain languages, certain scripts, and things that may not work that a developer doesn't see. They see a thing called terminal open.
But it's also something they shouldn't have to see.
Yeah.
They are concerned about how the user interacts with the design, not concerned with the language that something's built in. And that has nothing to do with the designer.
I agree. It has nothing to do with the designer. I think it's more of saying, if I want control over how this interaction should happen, because in user testing, we've worked out that out of these two ABs, this interaction is the best. I need to then be able to convey that to a developer in developer speak, but not sort of saying that this is how a server was set up. It's more of, you know, that technical side. It's more of being able to say, if a user taps and holds this for 3 milliseconds, then this should happen.
Yeah.
Instead of a developer going, oh, but what happens when a user taps and holds onto this? And then a designer going, I don't know, because I don't know what should happen. Leave it with me and I'll find out. Or we could just nut it out right here and get an answer pretty quick.
And how far away from the border should they be able to tap before it's recognized as tap on the button?
Mm-hmm.
There's always another question to ask. And that's part of the frustrating problem, because there's no single tool that's going to answer all of the questions, and there's no single perfect tool that will solve all of the problems.
Yeah.
And I don't even know why I'm in this industry. It is so frustrating. And yet, at the same time, it's also so rewarding.
Yeah.
To see things that you've built that other people use and that they get enjoyment out of it.
Yeah.
The end result is rewarding enough to be able to persevere through these pain points and to be able to endure it and to be able to want to keep working with good designers and not just designers that you've built up a rapport with, but also designers where you don't have that rapport, you don't understand how they work, but you can see that they have passion for what they do.
Mm.
In a way that is also going to produce good results eventually.
Mm-hmm.
It may cause you frustration in the meantime, but that's just part of the process of working through it and getting to the point where you can work with them, to the point where you don't need to ask so many questions and don't need to have so many revision processes.
Yeah.
And it's almost like you get a designer on board, you put them into the design team, and then you sit them down with each developer, you know, assign them to a new developer every week and force them to only develop things by telling the developer what to change on the screen.
Hmm.
You know, that forced sort of frustration helps everybody understand both what the designer is trying to impart by what they're saying and also the developer to be able to interpret the intention of what the designer is saying, because not every designer is going to describe things in the same way.
Yeah.
And you don't expect people to do that.
So it's more learned by doing.
By developing relationships.
Yeah.
And that's something that you can only get over time. You can't expect a designer just to walk into a job and just because they've had, you know, 500 years of a Photoshop experience doesn't mean that they can tell a developer exactly how a website should look.
Yeah.
It has absolutely no correlation. They can have zero people skills and that's going to rule them out completely for the job. Maybe you should take them for a round of Pictionary and have that determine how well they're going to fit in with the job.
Mm.
There's no good answer, but a lot of it comes down to intuition and how that designer or developer or copywriter or project manager interacts with people.
Mm.
And having those people skills is a lot more important, even though I am self-confessedly not a people person. Having those people skills is still so important to be able to get your work done. I'm not a people person in that I don't like crowds. Not that I don't like people on one-to-one. There are a lot of people that I find really warm to talk to, that understand me, people that I'm also okay to have a complete black and blue argument with.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a matter of learning how to interact with those people in a way that can get your work done, not in a way that will reduce confrontation, because sometimes confrontation is a good thing.
Yeah.
There's nothing wrong with asking the right questions, even though they're going to aggravate somebody. That's not something that people should shy away from, because you're not going to help people just by pandering to them all the time.
Yeah. You'll end up walking away more frustrated.
Absolutely, yeah. So I guess make everybody argue with you.
So it sounds like a lot of the stuff that we talked about at the beginning, the fear of failure is through talking and asking questions, and mm-hmm. it doesn't matter if they're silly questions. But it's also understanding how to collaborate in a team environment, and UX is not just outward facing, it's also internal facing. Understand how developers use certain things or do think why they do certain things, and being able to adjust for that when you're putting a case forward. And it goes back to the core values of, like we said, if you go to a coffee shop and get somebody to test an app, which can be quite scary, but the more you do it, the more confident you become, the more influential you feel you can become as well. Because you've become used to speaking, it just starts to roll off your tongue. You feel like you know what you're talking about. You can then sell something to a client a lot easier, or a stakeholder internally, or to a creative director in a stand-up meeting.
Mm-hmm. So takeaway is don't be afraid to be yourself.
Yep.
And don't be afraid to ask questions.
Mm-hmm. If I had to put takeaways in, let's say if we were doing Carl's takeaways and mine, don't be afraid to fail. And if you're going from freelance into a corporate or agency environment, don't be afraid to fail in any of those areas. If the agency or corporate environment you're going to go into doesn't embrace failure, then it's probably not the best place to be in. Although
it also doesn't mean it's the wrong place to be in.
Yeah.
It may not be the best place, but at the same time, we also understand that people still need a job.
Yes.
They still need a team to work with. And, you know, sometimes you have to work with a team that may not be, that you may not feel best suits you, but you still need to pay your bills at the end of the day.
Mm. And you'll always learn from being in that team. You'll always have something to learn from. If you're an early starter, so if we're talking about a broad spectrum of listeners in the past and in the future of this recording, if you're a student, get into an agency or corporate environment and then go freelance. If you're going to go freelance, do a lot of homework, but don't be afraid to fail. For anybody that's a mid and a senior UX or UI designer, maybe start to learn a bit more Fed. Not saying that you have to be a Fed, but just learn about that area if you feel that you're not as polished as you want to be. And whether that's just doing a quick general assembly course or just learning something through Treehouse Online, that's basically how I learn a lot of stuff. Just investing time in yourself, because then, A, it'll help further your career, help further validating arguments when you're talking to a developer or a team. Always try and learn more. And I think what we've worked out is there's no tools to help. There are tools to help you do one component, but there's not a tool that can help you do all of it. You're going to have to pick and choose what you need to go into battle.
So learn to relate to people.
Learn to relate. Mm.
And a big difference between working for an agency or a corporation versus freelancing is that when you do encounter failure, you don't have that trampoline, that net to catch you.
Yeah.
And that's the scary part of it, which is why it's also so much more tempting to outsource things, to, you know, blame somebody else for failure.
Mm.
And it's no better or worse than working for somebody else. It's just different. You have to learn how to handle those situations and deal with it when the time arises.
Pretty much.
Mm. Cool. So, Chris, tell people where they can find you.
So at the moment, I'm on Twitter, at Chris Stone Street or C Stone Street. I just need to double check that one.
It's C Stone Street.
C Stone Street.
And you have a private account. Does that mean that people have to be approved before they can see what you say?
That is correct. Because of spam, basically, you get a lot of spam.
Out of curiosity, so I follow you. That's okay. If when you make tweets, is there any difference? Can you choose between things that can be public and can be private?
I've never looked into it.
Oh.
I don't know.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm more of a, I only tweet when I feel as though it's worth, it's a, it has some merit to an argument or some sort of substance to a message. I'm a very sit back and watch what other people tweet. And then if I feel, gee, this relates, I'll do a retweet. But I keep it private in the sense that, yes, you get a lot of spammers kind of, hey, I mean, Twitter's based around how many followers you have as well. You follow me, I'm more inclined to go back and follow you. That's how marketers kind of look at it. So I'm kind of, you know, a bit choosy about who follows me, because if I follow you back, I want to make sure that what you're tweeting is worth substance and not just, this is the latest craft beer that I've got. Cool.
Whereas I've got my DMs open.
Mm-hmm.
And I found Twitter really interesting, really refreshing change from Facebook because of the open source work I've been doing lately, you know, contributing to ReSwift, the iOS framework.
Mm.
And having other iOS developers to talk to on Twitter has been so invaluable to feeling part of the community and feeling like what you're doing is something worthwhile.
Yeah.
And that's something that, you know, I just didn't get on any other platform.
Yeah, I agree. I shut down my Facebook or my account's inactive because it came a point where, like many people, you're lying in bed, you're looking at memes of cats and how many people have had a baby or whatever it may be.
I love cat pictures.
A lot of developers do love cat memes, I've noticed. But then I thought, well, Twitter I saw as more of a professional side of interaction. So instead of seeing which high school friend that you have not talked to in 10 years has just had a baby, why not put that effort into seeing what someone in your industry is tweeting about?
Hmm.
And unfortunately, you never stop learning. So you're better off to pull your... Fortunately. That you're better off to pull your resources into Twitter. So I'm on Twitter, yeah.
Now, the business you had when you were freelancing, have you completely stopped that or are you still open to freelance work?
So at the moment, I'm closing off... I did have active three projects. One and a half-ish are kind of closed off. But no, I'm not looking towards picking up new projects only because time. And I haven't really slept for the last 2.5 years. So it's more of everything that we've talked about today is one reason why I'm not moving towards projects. Because with every new project, you're kind of having to feel like you redo the same processes to just get it across the line.
Mm-hmm.
And now I'm trying to focus more on building up my craft and my skill and what I can do in my current workplace. So investing where I'm at instead of investing for personal gain out of finances through a project. So,
yeah. Part of the frustration with quoting on projects is that what I didn't understand at the time is that these projects are always going to need ongoing development as well.
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't accept any more freelance projects, but there is still ongoing work in all of the projects that I've done that I need to maintain. And that's something that I don't think people in an agency or corporate environment really value, that when they decide to go freelance,
mm-hmm.
as soon as they do, the projects they receive, they're expected to maintain for the future.
Yeah. And a lot of designers don't account for that in terms of billings.
Yeah.
They just see it as start to end, this is the value, but clients always need support. And
let's quote on the project and worry about the rest later.
Yeah. And that's an argument we could go into later on about CMSs and...
Next week.
We could do that. Yeah.
Cool.
Thank you very much.
So I'm Carl Bowden on Twitter. You can DM me because I'm not private.
I'll go on private now. I twisted my arm. I'll go on private and I'm at C Stone Street. C Stone Street, yep.
Just to remind you of your last name.
Thank you.
And show notes can be found at loomstate.fm/NAN/1. Yes, episode 1. NAN for not a number.